WMRA News, I'm Bob Levicky. Charlottesville's school board approves a new collective bargaining agreement. A PAC that opposes Virginia's redistricting referendum is criticized for using imagery and language from the civil rights movement. And a state Senate committee votes down a proposal to create an independent gaming commission. This is the WMRA Daily for Tuesday, March 10th. Charlottesville's school board unanimously approved a new collective bargaining agreement at its meeting last week. Hannah Davis-Reed with Partner Station VPM reports.
The Charlottesville Education Association negotiated a 10.5% raise for support staff like custodians for fiscal year 2027 through 2029. Chair Lisa Torres signed the contract with the union.
That's a big yay.
In February, the board backtracked on the agreement with the union, causing union members to push back. During public comments, CEA Vice President Michael Salvatierra celebrated its passage. At the same time, he called on the division to apologize for a February community email that offered support professionals a 3% raise instead of the expected 10.5%.
You want to restore trust? You have to begin the repair.
School board member Chris Meyer said the board got, quote, really bad legal advice when the email went out, leading to communication that he said wasn't productive or constructive. In retrospect, he said he would have written the message differently or called union members on the phone.
Hannah Davis-Reed reporting. A political action committee opposing Virginia's April 21st redistricting referendum is facing sharp criticism. The Virginia Mercury reports the PAC sent mailers to voters over the weekend that invoke imagery and language from the civil rights movement. Voting rights activists say that distorts history and risks misleading voters. The mailers were distributed by a group called Democracy and Justice PAC, led by former Republican delegate A.C. Cordoza. They feature black and white imagery reminiscent of 1960s civil rights demonstrations. One piece shows a photograph of a large march with protesters, many of them black, carrying signs as they walk down a city street. Virginia Attorney General Jay Jones, the state's first black attorney general, said the mailers draw on a painful chapter of American history that should not be used as a political tool. A Senate committee voted down a proposal to create an independent gaming commission Monday. Currently, a patchwork of agencies regulate gambling in Virginia. Jad Khalil with our partner station VPM reports.
Lawmakers are debating expanding gambling in different ways this session. One proposal would let people play casino games on their mobile phones, for example. That would bring in millions in tax dollars. But before lawmakers expand gambling, Governor Abigail Spanberger's administration wants the General Assembly to consolidate how it's regulated. Fairfax Democrat Delegate Paul Krizek pitched his bill to the Senate Finance Committee on Resources.
It's time that we bite the bullet and put it all into one. We've got too many agencies regulating gaming as it is right now.
Senators on the committee want the Virginia Lottery to regulate gambling instead. Senator Cree Deeds is a Democrat representing Charlottesville.
Our concern was just creating a separate bureaucracy than the one we already have, the lottery.
A competing bill would have the lottery do that, but the House and Senate need to reach a compromise on how it would exactly.
Jad Khalil reporting. Governor Abigail Spanberger is considering legislation that would ban the sale of assault-style weapons. Virginia Public Radio's Michael Pope has the latest.
Virginia may be on the verge of banning the sale of assault-style weapons. Here's Senate Majority Leader Scott Surovell.
There's some things you can't buy today, like flamethrowers or rocket launchers. You can't have your own tank. That's the law in America today. Why? Because these are weapons of war that are used to kill humans. They're designed to maximize human carnage and to kill people. You don't hunt animals with a tank or a flamethrower.
The legislation banning the sale, manufacture, or transfer of assault-style weapons and large-capacity magazines was sent to the governor's desk on a party-line vote. Here's Senator Bryce Reeves, a Republican from Orange County.
If we don't have the Second Amendment, we're going to end up like Venezuela one day, or we're going to end up like all these other countries that don't have the ability to fight for their freedom against tyranny. And many of the other side of the aisle are worried about our current president and whether or not he's going to try to run again and all these other things that are out there. And for argument's sake, let's say he did. How are you going to stop him? Well, if you take away all the firearms from the law-abiding citizens, I don't think they're going to be able to do anything.
A spokeswoman for the governor says that as a mother of three daughters in Virginia public schools and a former federal law enforcement officer who carried a gun every day, Governor Spanberger knows the importance of making sure kids and families are safe. Reporting from the Capitol in Richmond, I'm Michael Pope.
Last Friday, in the House of Delegates, Virginia's National Guard leader discussed the Guard's involvement overseas. Major General James Ring told lawmakers the 229th Military Police Company out of Hanover is providing support in the Middle East, while a Powhatan unit is stationed near the Horn of Africa. Delegate Dan Helmer, a lieutenant colonel in the Army Reserve, asked if Virginia's guardsmen are going to potential hostile zones.
We on the Virginia Guard side right now, regarding current operations with Epic Fury, don't currently have any anticipated mission sets beyond our F-22s with the 192nd Wing supporting those.
Ring said the Guard always trains for complex missions. Lawmakers in Richmond wanted to require that political ads include a disclosure if they were made with AI. That effort was changed into a new speedy defamation review Monday morning. Virginia Public Radio's Brad Kuttner reports.
Fairfax Democratic Senator Saddam Saleem had hoped to require disclosure on political ads that use artificial intelligence, but a House committee Monday turned his bill into an anti-defamation law that asked courts to quickly review complaints related to allegedly false political ads instead. Here's Saleem.
A candidate or an individual could go ahead and bring suit, and the courts would have to make it a priority to hear so that the information that's inaccurate, it's still not out there.
The change came somewhat at the last minute, which isn't uncommon with less than a week left in the 2026 General Assembly session. Committee Chair Democrat Cliff Hayes said the bill was about keeping voters informed.
We're going to frame the bill as a tool to protect the integrity of elections, ensuring voters aren't manipulated.
The bill passed out of committee Monday morning, and with it will go a letter asking that the issue of political ads be studied before the 2027 lawmaking session. But in the meantime, First Amendment advocate and attorney John Coleman with the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression still has concerns with the bill.
The bill invites candidates to address false speech with lawsuits against speakers rather than to address it with more speech that lets voters rather than the courts decide who's correct.
Coleman also warned the 30-day timeline for the courts to hear such claims was unrealistic. In Richmond, I'm Brad Kuttner.
When should police officers render aid to people in need? The General Assembly is hashing that issue out as well. Michael Pope has the story.
When should a police officer stop what they're doing and render aid to someone suffering from a serious injury or a life-threatening condition?
I candidly have always assumed that a law enforcement officer driving past the scene of an accident would have a duty to stop and help.
That's Delegate Rip Sullivan, a Democrat from Fairfax County, questioning the need for a bill introduced by Delegate Dan Helmer, another Democrat from Fairfax County.
We don't specifically articulate that in code, and I think in most instances, an officer who sees this would actually stop. So yes, we are explicitly articulating in code that there is a duty to render aid.
His bill would not only add that requirement to the code, but it would also set training standards for future law enforcement officials. One of the voices speaking out against the bill is David Ostwinkle at the Virginia State Police Association.
There are instances where there are priorities for police officers to not render aid and to take other action. For example, to secure a scene or to secure a suspect.
The bill has already been passed by the House and will be considered by the Senate this week. Reporting from the Capitol in Richmond, I'm Michael Pope.
Bill Kellums, VHF Records, has been releasing music for more than 30 years, issuing everything from shoegaze to string band and improvised music. Some of the groups he's worked with have been based in Europe or Asia, but a lot of the label's catalog has been drawn from Virginia talent. Virginia Public Radio's Dave Cantor has the story.
It's okay if an album doesn't recoup its costs for 20 years, Bill Kellum said while sitting in his Albemarle County home office, surrounded by hundreds of LPs and CDs. Kellum began performing in his own bands while studying at James Madison University, merging avant-rock and burbling electronics. The guitarist eventually settled in Northern Virginia and connected with a DC area rock scene that at the time included Teen Beat Records acts like Unrest. He caught live shows at DC Space and the 930 Club, but also traveled through the Commonwealth playing and seeing live music, including a few notable Charlottesville bills.
So I remember seeing Sonic Youth at Trax in 1990, saw Jesus Lizard, Superchunk, Mudhoney, all those bands there. And that was kind of another thing for me, is like, once you see a performance that really reaches you up close, you know, without all the production, without it being 100 yards away from you, without there being like a kind of showbiz aspect to it that's off-putting, it really like rewires you.
Watching those groups gain notoriety at the same time Kellum was beginning to release his own music demystified the industry a bit, and attending all those shows helped him meet a raft of performers who'd eventually release music through VHF. Those encounters also made Kellum think his talents were best suited to running a label, not performing or setting up shows. Mike Gangloff, a fiddler now based in Southwest Virginia, met Kellum in Richmond during the 90s. Since then, he's released more than a dozen albums through VHF.
The kind of music that Bill has championed, I mean, it's been quite a range. And while I think it all kind of has a certain psychedelic, artsy coherence, I'm not sure that there are many other small labels that have had the persistence and the range that he's had.
Gangloff, cellist Kaylee Shanker, and guitarist Jesse Shepard released their debut recording as Universal Light through VHF earlier this month. The group combines Appalachian string music and what Gangloff called directed improvisation. They've set up a brief March tour through North Carolina and Virginia. Gangloff also credits the label owner for helping foster an earlier band he played in, called Pelt.
For Pelt, it's hard to think what we would have done without Bill. The whole course that we took was aided by his mixing and his giving us the gear to actually record the sounds in the first place.
Jack Rose, who'd go on to establish himself as a solo performer before passing away in 2009, was a member of the group with Gangloff for more than a decade. Rose's fingerstyle playing helped reignite interest in a unique strain of American guitar music. Kellum counts his Opium Music recording among his favorite VHF releases, and said Rose's Kensington Blues ranks as one of the imprint's best-selling albums.
And it kind of has like everything he does. There's some, you know, American primitive style stuff, and there are a couple of extended kind of raga type pieces on it. So it really is, you know, great from start to end. And it's got something for everybody, I guess, maybe is a good way to think of it.
VHF never moved a ton of merchandise, despite releasing Rose's briskly selling work, as well as a number of recordings by the well-regarded British group Flying Saucer Attack, Kellum said. And like the industry as a whole, sales have decreased over time, but making a mint wasn't ever the goal.
I mean, the label is just a conduit for those people. Like, I kind of think of it like the coolest restaurant in your town is probably not the big chain, right? It's a funky place that you like that's not like anything else. And the most interesting person you know is different from everybody else. And that's kind of where, like, I think our music sits. It's got a unique quality to it that for people who are interested in something different, you know, fills that need.
I'm Dave Cantor.
Finally today, Maryland is lifting the closure of shellfish waters on the Potomac River. Harvests of shellfish were shut down in January after the Potomac Interceptor pipe near Washington, D.C. burst, creating one of the largest sewage spills in the region. For oystermen 60 miles downstream, that created a public relations nightmare. Virginia Public Radio's Pamela D'Angelo reports.
Last week, the Potomac River Fisheries Commission extended oyster harvest to April 14th. And while ice in February prevented work boats from going out on the Potomac, it was the sewage spill that really hurt oyster sales. Bill Kalinske is an oyster buyer.
One of the middlemen. I buy oysters and resell them to other people.
Those include shuck houses and restaurants. Then came the sewage spill. Out of an abundance of caution, Maryland, which oversees the Potomac River, immediately shut down oystering in the closest shellfish waters, about 60 miles from the spill site in Charles County, Maryland, before testing those waters for E. coli and other dangerous bacteria.
They did do a precautionary closure on all shellfish, being specifically oysters or clams, not crabs or fish, from the 301 bridge north.
When Maryland conducted tests, they found no contamination. On February 26th, the Maryland Department of Environment posted a video promoting Potomac River oysters are safe to eat. But Kalinske said the damage was done.
But the consumer across the nation specifically said we did not want oysters from the Potomac River, which truly impacted our fishery.
With the season extended and a banner year for harvest, oystermen are trying to get the word out that their oysters were never affected. From the Potomac River Fisheries Commission, I'm Pamela D'Angelo.
For WMRA News, I'm Bob Levicky. I appreciate your listening, and I hope you enjoy your Tuesday.